right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, August 22nd, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a balmy 78 degrees and partly sunny here in upstate New York with severe thunderstorms forecast for later this afternoon. So it should be interesting. So where do we leave off yesterday? I haven't said that in a long time. We titled the show Death, Physics, Energy, FCC, 5G, IOE, as in the Internet of Everything, NSA, CIA, Google, and Skynet. And that pretty much encompasses all the different topics we touched upon yesterday, kind of tying together the last three or four or five shows that we've talked about, just looking at this influence of technology on the things that really make us living entities. We've been looking at frequencies, light, matter, energy, and the transfer between the different states of matter and how potentially photons never die. That was something we covered a couple of different times that they've discovered now, and how your energy, when you look at physics, matter is never created or ever destroyed. It just changes form. And I really think that that is a key. And as they are rolling out these ubiquitous technologies, the Internet of Things, the Internet of Everything, 5G being the next edition, and they reach higher and higher frequencies, that they will be beaming us silently and invisibly in our environments, how that is going to affect our physiology, our biology, and what that potentially could be doing to us. Now, we've talked a lot about Dr. Smartphone, IBM Watson, Watson for president, Watson for oncologist, and this rolling out of wearable devices. Well, there's some real irony in what happened to me this summer, having my post-brain event. You know, I've been going to all these doctor's appointments, sending me here, there, and everywhere. So one of the newest things is they want to find out where this clot came from, and there's a couple different ways. I think I've talked about them over the last few months. Low oxygen levels is a bad one. Heart arrhythmia is another. If your heart has a hiccup, it could start spitting out clots. Inactivity, which is why I said sitting is the next smoking, because this job requires a lot of sitting, and it hasn't been good for me. But there's a bunch of different ways that you can get clots, and so they want to discover where. So the cardiologist appointment I came home for yesterday, I was coming back because they ordered a device for me, and it was going to be a monitoring device to see if they could detect arrhythmia. And I had to wear it for 30 days, and it was going to be live streaming my data. Now, how many times have we talked about Dr. Smartphone and the 21st Century Cures Act? So I really find it interesting that I'm in the pickle that I'm in right now, because some things happened today. No names. I just want to share with you the experience, because this is a new budding industry, and there are a lot of people out there that are trying to make money, and there are a lot of consumers out there that don't know the rules of the game. But shame on me for being in the industry for 20 plus years that I didn't even talk about these things yesterday until I had time to think about them quietly this morning. But there's some definite problems going on with this remote monitoring industry. First and foremost, I get there, they pull the device out of the box. She dials in to their system. She registers the device and registers it to me, the patient. And then I have to put the little leads on. So I have four leads on my chest, just like you do in the hospital when they're doing heart monitoring. And then there was a little smartphone device that was pretty interesting, because the company that came in, the one that she was connecting to, could come in because we were having problems detecting two of the leads. And we see all the screens moving around, bing, 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 bing. So talk about like mass surveillance. Who knows what they can see or hear? I mean, it's their closed cellular device. And just like the NSA can open your cell phone, open your camera, open your microphone, I'm sure that they could do the exact same thing. We saw them manipulating the screens. Why couldn't they do anything else? But what's even more interesting is that last night I went online and I searched the company who's providing the software as a service, the monitoring software on this cellular device, and found out that there were a bunch of lawsuits out there between them and the insurance company. And I was pretty distressed by that. Why would my doctor's office be giving me a device that had questionable history with being covered by insurance? And so much so that they had an antitrust lawsuit. So the question that I had this morning was for the insurance company. I called them up. I asked them about it, asked them if the device was covered. They came back and told me, no, guess what? First of all, they didn't know anything about a lawsuit, but guess what? It's considered an out-of-network device, which means that there's a $500 copay, and then they only cover 80% thereafter. Now, a couple of things as the consumer of the service, I thought back to my appointment yesterday when they set everything up, and there were no agreements or no explanations of how I'm being billed for this. Is it per megabyte that's being streamed directly to their monitoring service, or is it per heartbeat? I mean, who knows? So no informed consent whatsoever, no privacy policy. I mean, I didn't see anything that says we're not going to use your data for clinical trials. We're not going to open the microphone to see what's going on in the ambient environment if we detect an anomaly. You know, and I mean, what are the crazy ironies that we've talked about all these things? And here I'm sitting in the lizard's pit again, and I was struck unaware just because I was at the doctor's office. You know, you kind of just want to do what you're told, and you hope that they're trying to help you. So I'm a little concerned. I put a call into them after the insurance company, and of course, they knew nothing about a lawsuit or that there was ever any issue being reimbursed by the insurance company. So I guess we're going to find out where this ends up. But from my perspective, I see that they made a couple big faux pas here. Obviously, they should have informed me that there might be a charge. But secondly, they should have picked a company that had a better track record with being approved. Now, I found a couple mainstream stories. One came out of Reuters, and this was 2016, a year ago, August 2nd. Remote heart monitoring can help detect emergencies, though they are trying to detect an arrhythmia and discover if maybe that potentially could be the issue. Another thing that can cause clots is sleep apnea. So for any of you people who snore out there or who tend to do really light breathing when you're sleeping, that potentially could be another thing. And they do have remote tests for that as well that you wear for a good month while you're sleeping every night. So anyway, instead of having heart monitors with noisy alarms near patients' beds in the hospital, it might be better to have off-site technicians do the heart monitoring remotely, says a recent study. Traditional on-site heart monitoring can involve a lot of false alarms that don't always help detect cardiac arrest and other serious events, says lead author of the study, Daniel Cantillon, a researcher at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, where they're also entertaining lots of help from IBM Watson. Important warnings are often missed among a large volume of nuisance alarms, and this refers to as the alarm fatigue, and it's been associated with serious adverse outcomes, including patient deaths across the United States. As an alternative, Callington and colleagues examined outcomes for more than 99,000 heart patients at the Cleveland Clinic in three nearby regional hospitals who were monitored remotely. And you know, I've always talked to you guys about the dashboard and big, simple colors, green for good, red for bad, yellow for uh-oh, we're having a downward change. That's the way we used to build things for corporate America, just to monitor networks. And we used to remote monitor networks as well for customers and sell it as a service. I'm telling you, that's what this is all coming to. Healthcare is going to be Dr. Smartphone. Remember, they'd even talked about being able to use the sound of your voice to be able to diagnose disease and mental disorders. I really think that this whole remote monitoring, all going to be done by 5G. You could hologram in your doctor in virtual reality with your goggles eventually to be able to come do a remote visit. And this is no joke, but The legal questions remain. Where does that leave the patient? What are your rights and responsibilities for paying for this stuff? And are the doctors, I mean, I know when we used to have resellers sell this stuff for us, we used to give them kickbacks. So every time you sold a subscription for a year or 30 days or whatever, you got a kickback of a decent amount of the subscription fee. Just makes you wonder where the consumer protections in all this are and whether or not by not checking that box, you actually checked a box because your doctor signed you up. I'm telling you guys, this is, if there was ever anything that got my blood pressure up, this really set it on a good course this morning, upward trend. I'm getting the beep, beep, beep live stream to my doctor's desktop right now or cell phone. Emergency response teams were activated in 3,200 cases, including 980 instances where the heart rhythm or blood pressure changes occurred no more than an hour earlier. So hopefully I don't have a rescue team show up here. In most of these warnings, 79% were accurate notifications of situations where patients needed urgent help, the study found. In addition, the remote technicians directly notified emergency technicians on the worsening conditions of 105 patients who needed immediate intervention. This includes advanced warnings of 27 cardiopulmonary arrests, all but two resulting in a return of circulation. Oh, God, they might show up here. The remote monitoring system also associated with was associated with a reduction in the total number of patients who needed monitoring at any given time, and the so-called weekly census dropped by almost 16% when compared with a prior 13-month period. Overall, remote monitoring didn't appear to lead to more cardiac arrests. There were 122 during the study and 126 in the previous 13 months. Limitations of the study include its observational design, which makes it impossible to determine if remote monitoring directly causes specific outcomes. To prove a benefit, researchers would need to randomly assign patients to receive on-site monitoring and other off-site monitoring. But the findings still suggest that the patients might benefit when dangerous events are identified and emergency response teams are activated quickly, says Clue, who wasn't involved in the study. In most hospitals, a certain proportion of beds are equipped with capability to monitor patients' heart and breathing in real time. The goal is to catch any warnings or abnormalities early so that critical events such as heart and lung arrest can either be prevented or managed rapidly. So there you have it. Wow, that's going to make me beyond paranoid now. That all it's going to take is me going bloop and we're going to have someone kicking the door in with gas masks. There was another website that I found. It was pretty interesting, and this, again, outlines the dashboard concept. There's a patient laying in bed, clinical decision-making uncomplicated. So you can focus on what matters most, i.e. your patients. So there's a whole thing in here about how you can set up your patients with remote sensor monitoring that are integrated wirelessly and bedside device data to a single platform so patient information becomes more meaningful. Paired with your intuition, it delivers it to you wherever you are on any device, designed to help make the right calls for your patients at the right time and prevent the preventable. You can do workflows. You can look at the clinical values and the economic benefits. So every decision you make has the power to save lives. So at the push of a button, boop, 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 you can manage your patients. Guys, this is where it's headed. I still can't believe that I have one of these devices on right now out of the Star Tribune. This was, someone's mowing the lawn right next to me. September 2012, FDA OK's remote heart monitor developed with the Mayo Clinic. This new system now allows doctors to track patients' heart rhythms from their offices. This remote monitoring system allows remote observation of individuals with cardiac arrhythmias. The technology will allow physicians to monitor their patients' ECGs, heart rates, respiration rates, and activity level while they go about their daily lives. Its maker, this company in particular, develops mobile health applications and expects to have it available by the end of the year. So this is 2012. Officials said Monday they will immediately begin selling the technology to hospitals and clinics and a small body sensor attached to the patient's chest transmits data through a specially programmed secure cell phone to a monitor. Then the data is made available to the patient's doctor, who can access their data at the office or while on the go. Although not yet commercially available, it will be prescribed by a physician when diagnostic and post-procedure monitoring is needed. We are thrilled that the FDA has provided clearance for our device, enabling preventative medicine to the market in a real-time remote connection between the physician and the patient. Their vision has been to maximize the industry-leading collaboration into a solution that enables healthcare providers to extend and improve care for their patients where they live. Guys, I'm telling you, if I ever go back to work for the machine, I know somebody who sells healthcare technology. I think I should pitch to them some of these companies that we've been reading about on this show and say, hey, I'll go sell this crap for you. Just give me a big fat commission, 15% on a monthly recurring basis if I sell the service. I think I can make $1 billion doing this, honestly, because this really is something that, I've spent a lot of time looking at this stuff, so I can't even believe that I am sitting right in the middle of this thing with one of these things tracking me now 24/7. This monitoring system is the first company to be selling its own product. And up until now, a private company has done the contract engineering, the software development for other companies. They intend to sell the system in the United States and Europe, and its operations were run in a couple different cities. This company is another example of technology companies, and among them, IBM and Microsoft are getting in the game as well as Google, that are entering the medical world as they see a potential mirroring of the huge benefits of data sharing with preventative healthcare. Now, remember, a lot of this is part of the 21st Century Cures Act, which was passed in December of 2016. So don't think that this stuff isn't flowing, and there aren't tons of investment from all of our lawmakers, as well as probably our healthcare professionals, in these technologies. They are seeing their cha-ching, new yacht, and Caribbean vacation as a part of all this. Whoever cracks the code is going to go to the moon, they said about this technology, and the company declined to discuss pricing for its device. Another challenge for remote monitoring is privacy and security. Ding-a-ling-a-ling. Just something that I did not sign any agreement for. This company has a secure data exchange platform that it disconnects any identifying information from heart rhythm data, transmits it, and then reconnects it to the doctor's system. The technology secures the information well, so they say. Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Charles Bruce was part of the team that developed this device's algorithms. He likens the system to a dashboard warning light, ding-a-ling. And when oil pressure needs attention, see, we're all going to be monitored like cars. A light alerts the driver. So too does this device. It sifts through the streams of data and only sends the information that needs attention. We had a vision of being able to identify problems before they occur, and if they occur, how we help patients live more easily with the problems that they face. The system was approved for use with people who may have irregular heartbeats but can otherwise get around. That would include me. And Bruce, who has worked on the idea since 1999 with a team that includes an engineer, Kevin Bennett, and Dr. Vernred Summons and Dr. Paul Friedman, says that the technology is meant to be a type of early warning system. I've become part of the Internet of Things. It is an exciting opportunity and an example of how we are having to look at the delivery of healthcare differently. This said the device wireless monitoring is becoming more common, and according to a recent study, an estimated 2.2 million patients worldwide are using this type of technology. Berg Insight analysts participate in wireless monitoring will involve 4.9 million patient connections in 2016. And in addition, there's another company that estimates the global patient monitoring market will reach $9.3 billion by 2014. And I bet that has doubled since then. Cha-ching! So to find out that this device is considered out of network, and I have a $500 upfront copay, and endless charges for 30 days of monitoring, is pretty disturbing to me. So I saw something else. There was a little video advert on Facebook yesterday that had these little devices that looked like smoke detectors on the ceiling, and they were shooting little red laser beams bzz, 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 down to the countertop where your cell phone was sitting, and it was called Y-Charge. Y-Charge promises phone charging by infrared laser. Bzz, 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 bzz. In the world of wireless gadgets, charging is still a big problem. And there is an Israeli startup called Y-Charge that is looking to change that by allowing us constant wireless charging using infrared laser technology. Broadly speaking, you can divide wireless power technologies into two technology categories. There's near field, and we looked at that last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago in one of the shows that we did. There was the near field charging because I posted a primer on it. Which is a few centimeters or even physical contact, and then far field. And in the near field category, there are quite a number of companies and several protocols that are being competing for close range wireless power delivery. And why this is important, of course, is as we're looking at 4 and 5G and our Internet of Things, you're going to have to provide power to these trillions of devices that are going to be invading our daily lives. All common commercial near field wireless power technology today uses either tightly coupled, which would be physical contact, transmitter, and receiver, or loosely coupled, which would be resonant within a few centimeters of a distance. In both cases, the transmitter and receiver need to be very close to each other. I need to be 10 feet from this little cell phone device. Far field technology, on the other hand, is still in its infancy, and though some startups such as Ubeam, and I think we looked at that, and Energys are promising big steps soon. And for the most part, all the approaches are limited in either distance or power or both. Well, Y-Charge believes its solution is different from its competitors to overcome their limits. Orbital Alpert, Wi-Fi's Charge founders, had worked for years developing advanced optical storage solutions for their former startup. And during this time, he frequently traveled the globe on business, which forced him to constantly look for places to charge mobile devices. And based on his experience as an optical engineer, he developed a new technology for wireless charging that uses infrared lasers and relies on two unique and now patented ideas. To best understand these ideas, remember the U.S. and Israel had their whole optical consortium, as well as Brain Neuroscience Consortium, that they were working on stuff together. To understand these ideas, we first need to go back to the laser and how it works. The laser is usually described as a device that bounces light between a pair of mirrors on either end of a gain medium, which then amplifies the light with each successive pass. Usually one of the mirrors inside of this cavity is partially transparent, allowing for some of the light to exit as a laser beam. Y-Charge's ingenious idea was to take this cavity, which is typically a closed device, and turn it into an open unit where one of the mirrors is located, for example, in a light fixture on the ceiling and then the other one on the receiving device. The semiconductor gain medium is located in the transmitter and provides the photons that are harvested from the photovoltaic cell at the receiver. Powerful lasers can be dangerous. However, Y-Charge uses a class 1 infrared laser, which is safe under all conditions of normal use. And more importantly, the external cavity design means that the instant anything crosses the path of the laser, your hand, your eye, amplification will stop and the energy will drop. So a second unique idea has to do with being able to fix and maintain the connection between the transmitter and the receiver. Y-Charge's design uses a retroreflective mirror instead of regular mirrors, and the reflect light back to its source with a minimum of scattering. So you can sometimes find retroreflective mirrors in road signs and bicycles, and even a few are left on the moon. By Apollo, they say. Using retroreflectors makes aligning the mirrors unnecessary, hence the beam is maintained even when the receiver is moving around, something demonstrated during a visit last year. During operation, well, that's great. So they can, while you have your cell phone, they can beam a laser at you using this retroreflective. And we're going to look at cell phones. I came across a Scientific American story yesterday called Mind Control by Cell Phone, which really kind of struck me. And that's something else when we look at frequency and light and optogenetics. You have to worry about during operation, the transmitter continuously sends very low powered, VLF, infrared signals across the room, and when it hits a retroreflector on the receiver, the signal is returned, and a connection is made to, and the amplification begins. The connection will be maintained as long as it is in range, and there is line of sight. Using a laser does have one distinct disadvantage. It requires line of sight between the transmitter and receiver, and this means you won't be able to charge your smartphone while it's in your pocket, and instead, which it shouldn't be. And that's something else I want to point out. They gave me this little cell phone device for monitoring my heart in this little cell phone case with a belt clip on it. Nowhere did I see in any documentation did it say this must be kept within so many feet of your body to not get any adverse reaction. I thought that was an FCC health thing, but they give you a belt clip so they can give it to 80-year-old Nana and say, here, Nana, go monitor your heart for the next 30 days. And look at this handy belt clip we provided you with it to wear it against your body. I mean, what is that? Anyway, let's see. One of the big advantages of white charge is the ability to deliver almost any amount of power from a few milliwatts for sensor power to hundreds of watts in an industrial, even military application. For the consumer market with devices such as smartphones and wearables, WhiteCharge is looking to start with a system capable of delivering 10 watts. Yeah, our bodies produce 20 watts, we found out. Why couldn't you just tap that? Unlike any other far-field technology, WhiteCharge has a pretty small footprint. So they want to beam laser beams at devices that are on our bodies. This is really kind of freaking me out. A receiver can be as small as your phone's camera module and still charge from a distance of 10 meters, says WhiteCharge. But for more power-demanding applications and longer ranges, both the transmitter and receiver will have to be larger, but not dramatically so. One potential application of the technology could be for powering a drone, for border patrol, or installation security. It is a scenario on a patrol car on top of a building or a tower from a distance of dozens or even hundreds of meters away and can stay in the air for countless hours or even days. I've seen about that, the endless drones using laser power. Laser power beaming isn't a new concept. Researchers from NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center and the University of Alabama powered a small-scale aircraft that flew slowly solely by means of propulsive power from a ground-based 1-kilowatt infrared laser back in 2003. And I thought they were talking about that with Hawking's mission to Alpha Centauri with those little mini, what are they calling them? Those little tiny little satellites, CubeSats. They were going to be using laser propulsion into a cone and doing the same sort of thing. Japan's aerospace exploration agency, JAXA, also presented an even more ambitious wireless power project in early 2015. And I think JAXA made it to Mars. Researchers from JAXA were able to deliver 1.8 kilowatts with a pinpoint accuracy, just like your brain. Did you ever see that Snoop Dogg video from his GCN or CGN network where he talked about why he'd never wear a headset or an earpiece? He's gonna blow up your head. With pinpoint accuracy to a receiving antenna that was 55 meters away times 3, that's 150 feet, using carefully directed microwaves. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. There you go, guys. I'm telling you, this is all not in your best interest. Seattle-based Laser Motive, which in 2006 won NASA Power Beam Challenge, is working on over-the-air as well as fiber optic cable transfer power to flying drones. And WhiteCharge says that its inherent safety and small footprint would allow ground to private and commercial drones in urban environment. In a typical use case scenario, one transmitter in the ceiling within a light fixture, for example, would be able to set a charge up for four devices inside a room. At a demo that WhiteCharge offices in Rivolt, Israel, we saw a working prototype that included a transmitter in the ceiling and a smartphone with a special case containing a mirror and a photovoltaic cell. It was able to charge from a distance of 3 meters, and the modified phone charged slower than if it had been plugged into a wall socket. But according to WhiteCharge, the final product will be able to charge one smartphone at the same rate as a wired charger, though the two devices will take longer. While we were there, we were showed a modified music player and a speaker that worked without any batteries in the same way. Albert promises the first product based on charges technology will be available in 2016 and would be Internet of Things and smart home related. I think I just heard a beep. I hope I didn't have an arrhythmia. A year later, the company was planning to release a residential mobile phone charging solution that will include a transmitter and a phone case at the retail price of just under $200. So what do you think of them, apples? So when we take a look at some of these things that are happening in these frequencies and lasers, I'm starting to freak out about that phone beeping. Researchers identify the conductor of the brain's neural orchestra and begin to decode the score. And this is out of a DARPA Dump Mill publication, April 18th, 2017. Researchers identify conductors of the brain's neural orchestra and begin to decode the score. New tools allow a detailed optical recording of cortex-wide activity in awake, behaving mammals. And a new analysis technique reveals broad coordination of the goal-directed behavior across your neocortex. Stanford University researchers, funded by DARPA's Neurofunction Activity Structure and Technology Program, which is the NeuroFast, have developed new optical imaging and analysis techniques that allow them to decode neural activity in the awake mice in an adaptive decision-making task. The findings of the Stanford team, made in collaboration with researchers at the California Institute of Technology, detailed this week in the journal Neuron, gives researchers a new insight into how the mammalian brain coordinates neural activity to complete voluntary behaviors versus involuntary. The team's overall results advanced DARPA's goal of building a knowledge base and toolkit within the neurotechnology community that can accelerate understanding of the brain structure and function. DARPA created a NeuroFast program to find new ways to see the brain, and the optical technologies we developed now allow researchers to conserve brain in detail as it processes behavior. DARPA's program manager says that the achievement helps us to identify roles played by individual neurons in coordinating and carrying out behaviors, and I think that this could be a cornerstone of the future neural interface technologies. It is set in a set of experiments. Transgenic mice learn to lick for water in the presence of a particular odor or refrain from licking in the presence of a second odor to avoid a puff of air. The behavior required the animals to integrate immediate stimuli in the form of an odor and then their own internal state and then past experience to rapidly and flexibly select and perform specific actions that help them achieve a particular goal of receiving water. Researchers combined the whole cortex wide field calcium imaging, a method in which genetically modified neurons fluoresce when activated, and tiled two photon microscopies that provided more detailed views of particular areas of the cortex. This allowed them to record across the entire neocortex of the mice's brains, and yet with enough resolution to reveal the spatial and temporal dynamics of the individual neural cell types and the neural circuits. And we've read a lot about being able to use optogenetics with lasers and manipulate the brains of mice. There was the one in particular that I remember about turning them into killers. Well, here's one from Scientific American, and this was from quite a while ago. I was very surprised. May 7th, 2008, long before I started doing the show, mind control by cell phone. Electromagnetic signals from cell phones can change your brain waves and your behavior, but don't break out the aluminum foil head shield just yet. Hospitals and airplanes ban the use of cell phones because their electromagnetic transmissions can interfere with sensitive electrical devices. Could your brain, or think about this one, how about even your heart, fall into that category? Of course, all your thoughts, sensations, and actions arise from bioelectricity generated by neurons and transmitted through complex neural circuits inside of our skulls. Electrical signals between neurons generate electrical fields that radiate out of brain tissue as electrical waves, and we just found out a couple shows ago they don't know where those electrical waves come from, that can be picked up by electrodes touching a person's scalp. Measurements of brain waves and EEGs provide powerful insight into brain function and valuable diagnostic tools for doctors, and I bet they could even monitor EEGs remotely by laser. You wait and see. Indeed, fundamental are brain waves to the internal workings of your brain, and they have become the ultimate legal definition of drawing the line between life and death, and we just read that story a couple shows ago as well. brainwaves change with a healthy person's conscious and unconscious mental activity and state of arousal. But scientists can do more with brainwaves than just listen in one brain at work and selectively control brain function with transcranial magnetic stimulation. We read about that also. That is a project that DARPA has been putting a lot of time and energy into. This technique uses powerful pulses of electromagnetic radiation beamed into a person's brain to jam or excite particular brain circuits. Ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling. And although, and I saw that they were doing research on transcranial magnetic stimulation and depression, as well as some mood manipulation and with some post-traumatic stress disorder. And although a cell phone is much less powerful than a transcranial magnetic stimulation device, the question still remains, could the electrical signals coming from a phone affect certain brain waves operating in resonance with cell phone transmission frequencies? After all, a caller's cerebral cortex, ding-a-ling, the one we were just reading about that DARPA was monitoring, is just centimeters away from the radiation broadcast from the phone's antenna. Two studies provide some revealing news. The first study, led by Rodney Croft of the Brain Science Institute of the Swinburne University of Technology in Melbourne, Australia, tested whether cell phone transmissions could alter a person's brainwaves. The researchers monitored the brainwaves of 120 healthy men and women while a Nokia 6110 cell phone, which is one of the most popular cell phones in the world, and Nokia also is the owner of Bell Labs, we discovered, who began a lot of the research on microwave transmissions way back in the early 1900s. Uh-oh, I just heard another noise from my device, which is one of the most popular cell phones in the world, was strapped to their head. A computer controlled the phone's transmissions in a double-blind experimental design, which meant that neither the test subject nor the researchers knew whether the cell phone was transmitting or idle while the EEG data was collected. The data showed that when the cell phone was transmitting, the power of a characteristic brainwave pattern called an alpha wave in the person's brain, we've talked about the different wavelengths, was boosted significantly. The increased alpha wave activity was greatest in brain tissue directly beneath the cell phone, strengthening the case that phones were responsible for an observable effect. Alpha wave rate fluctuate at the rate of 12 cycles per second hertz, and these brainwaves reflect a person's state of arousal and attention. Alpha waves were generally regarded as an indicator of reduced mental effort, which is called cortical idling or mind wandering. But this conventional view is perhaps oversimplification. Croft, for example, argues that alpha waves are really regulating the shift of attention between external and internal inputs. Alpha wave increases in power when a person shifts his or her consciousness from the external world to internal thoughts. So also, they are a key brainwave signature of sleep. Ding-a-ling. So if a cell phone signal boosts a person's alpha waves, does this nudge them subliminally into an altered state of consciousness or have any effect at all on the workings of their mind that can be observed in a person's behavior? In the second study, James Horn and colleagues at the Loughborough University of Sleep Research in England devised an experiment to test this question, and the results were surprising. Not only could a cell phone signal alter a person's behavior during a call, but the effects of the disrupted brainwave patterns continued long after the phone was switched off. This was a completely unexpected finding. We didn't expect any effect on the EEG after switching the phone off. We were interested in studying the effect of the mobile phone signal on sleep itself, but it quickly became obvious to Horn that colleagues in preparing for the sleep research experiment that some of the test subjects had difficulty falling asleep. Horn and his colleagues controlled a Nokia 6310E cell phone, another popular basic phone, and attached it to the head of 10 healthy but sleep-deprived men in their research lab. The sleep had been restricted to 6 hours the previous night, and the researchers then monitored the men's brainwaves by EEG while the phone was switched on and off by a remote computer and also switched between standby, listen, and talk modes of operation for 30-minute intervals on different nights. The experiment revealed that after the phone was switched to talk mode, a different brainwave pattern called a delta wave in the range of 1 to 4 hertz remained dampened for nearly an hour after the phone was turned off. These brain waves are the most reliable and sensitive markers of two stages of sleep. Approximately 50% of sleep consists of one of these stages, and the subject remained awake twice as long after the phone transmitted in talk mode was turned off. Although the test subjects had been sleep deprived the night before, they could not fall asleep for nearly an hour after the phone had been operating without their knowledge. Although the research shows that cell phone transmissions can affect a person's brainwaves with persistent effects on behavior, Horn does not feel that there is any concern that cell phones are damaging. The arousal effects the researchers measured are equivalent to about half a cup of coffee and many other, of course, you know, just eat one banana and don't worry about it, Johnny. And many other factors in a person's surroundings will affect a night's sleep as much as one or more cell phone transmissions. The significance of the research, he explained, but what it is showing is that the cell phone does have an effect on your brain waves. I mean, that should be significant in and of itself. The significance of the research, he explained, is although the cell phone is powered, its power is low, electromagnetic radiation can nevertheless have an effect on our mental behavior when transmitting at the proper frequency. Ding, ding, ding. He finds this fact especially remarkable when considering that everyone is surrounded by an electromagnetic clutter, and that's what we said, it's ubiquitous, radiating from all kinds of electronic devices in our modern world. Cell phones and talk modes seem to be particularly well-tuned to frequencies that can affect brainwave activity, and that's what I said, down in the lower of the spectrum. And the result shows sensitivity to low-level radiation to a subtle degree. These findings open the door by a crack for more research to follow, and one only wonders if with different doses, durations, and other devices would be greater effects. Yeah, like as we start getting into some of these other frequencies, or being able to let the machine run the allocation of these frequencies. And we've talked about that also. That is the DARPA Spectrum Collaboration Challenge, putting AI in charge of allocating what is being done on these frequencies. And Elon Musk came out the other day and had a lot to say about AI. Kraft of Swyborn emphasizes that there are no health worries, of course, from these new findings, so he doesn't get sued. And the exciting thing about the research is that it allows us to have a look at how you might modulate brain function. And this tells us something about how the brain works on a fundamental level. In other words, the importance of this work is illuminating the fundamental workings of the brain, and scientists can now splash away with their own self-generated electromagnetic waves and learn a great deal about how brain waves respond and what they do. Ding-a-ling. Guys, this is Danger Will Robinson. This is being able to manipulate you remotely, accidentally or on purpose. And it's got to be worrisome to at least some of you out there. I know it is to me because they could do this en masse. We looked a lot at those Gwen towers and some of the uses. Those are all microwave transmission. And now it's even more ubiquitous as 5G is coming on board and the Spectrum Collaboration Challenge is becoming a part of the picture. This is out of the Spectrum Collaboration Challenge.com/about. What is the Spectrum Collaboration Challenge across the nation and across the world? And we found out this March Toward 5G is a global initiative with global timelines. The wireless revolution is fueling a voracious demand for access to radio frequency spectrum. In the civilian sector, consumer devices from smartphones to wearable fitness recorders, ding ding, to smart kitchen appliances are all competing for bandwidth. And in the military, there is a growing reliance on unmanned platforms as well as underwater sensors, two satellites, which would be using VLF transmission, and a push for broadband connectivity, 5G, for every member of the service. Managing this increased demand while combating what appears to be a looming scarcity of RF spectrum is a serious problem for our nation. So don't worry about a problem-reaction-solution. Today's approach, which is nearly a century old, isolates wireless systems by dividing the spectrum into rigid, exclusively licensed bands, which are allocated over large, geographically defined regions. And the approach rations access to a spectrum in exchange for the guarantee of interference-free communications. However, it is human-driven and not adaptive to the dynamics of supply and demand. So we can make a bazillion more dollars if we just give it all up to the machine. At any given time, there are many allocated bands that are unused by licensees while other bands are overwhelmed, thus squandering the spectrum's enormous capacity and unnecessarily creating conditions of scarcity. The Spectrum Collaboration Challenge aims to ensure that the exponentially growing number of military and civilian wireless devices will have full access to the increasingly cloudy and crowded electromagnetic spectrum. Competitors will reimagine spectrum access strategies and develop new wireless paradigms in which radio networks will automatically and autonomously collaborate and reason about how to share the RF spectrum, avoiding interference and jointly exploiting opportunities to achieve the most efficient use of available spectrum. The teams will develop these breakthrough capabilities by taking advantage of recent advantages and advances in artificial intelligence and machine learning, and the expanding capabilities of software-defined radios. Ultimately, this competition aims not only at challenging innovators in academia and business to produce breakthroughs in collaborative AI, but also to catalyze a new spectrum paradigm that can help usher in an era of spectrum abundance, and that would be going to higher frequencies and being able to splice and dice. It used to be called... we used to do it with fiber. I don't remember what it's called, but you used to multiplex and splice and dice and just transfer back and forth between or bond channels together to make bigger pipes on the fly. And guys, I was talking about Terminator. Well, we found the newest Terminator, which was called Genesis. I think it was put out in 2015 or 16 after Arnold left being governor. I have to say, I didn't have Arnold as governor, but I got to tell you, he is one of my favorite actors. He cracks me up. And seeing him in Terminator is just makes me smile, but then it really gives me chills because it's exactly the kind of thing that we are dealing with right now is Skynet and the development of Skynet. Well, Elon Musk has been one of those very vocal few tech billionaires who has come out against the machine. And there was a story from yesterday, I believe, but sometimes let me see if there's a date, because sometimes I see it brand new in my feed, and then it ends up being from 2-3 years ago. Come on, scroll, baby, scroll. Elon Musk is very freaked out by this artificial intelligence system's victory over humans. And August 14th, 2017, he tweeted, there was a picture of it looks like a billboard of a woman. And she's sitting there looking thoughtfully off into the distance with her finger on her mouth. And she's sitting, I don't know, in a place that looks like it's got boards on the window. And in the back it says, or actually across the bottom it says, in the end, the machines will win. With all that's happened in the world, Elon Musk wants to make sure that you don't forget about what he thinks to be the biggest danger to humanity. Over the weekend, Musk returned to tweeting about one of his favorite topics of discussion, artificial intelligence, and he referenced the threat of nuclear war with Korea to help make his point. And underneath this poster of this woman, and it says, in the end, the machines will win, he tweets, if you're not concerned about AI safety, you should be vastly more risk than North Korea. And then he says, nobody likes to be regulated, but everything, cars, planes, food, drugs, etc., that is a danger to the public. Oh, my browser is beginning to have a choke. There's a danger to the public, so it is regulated. AI should be as well. Musk tweets came hours after an AI system developed by OpenAI defeated some of the world's best players in a military strategy game called Dota 2, which reminded me of the War Games movie. According to a blog post by OpenAI, successfully playing the game involves predicting how an opponent will move, improvising under unfamiliar scenarios, and convincing the opponent's allies to help you instead. OpenAI is a nonprofit artificial intelligence company by Musk, co-founded along with Peter Thiel and Sam Altman, and the company's purpose is to research and develop AI and develop best practices to help ensure that the technology is used for good. I don't know about Musk being in cahoots with Thiel on this. I don't trust Thiel as far as I can throw him. Musk has called out AI in the past as humanity's biggest existential threat. A known AI fearmonger, he recently got public got into a public spat with Mark Zuckerberg about the dangers of AI, and I think I mentioned that one, and that the technology poses to humans. Zuckerberg, whose Facebook, like Tesla, invests heavily in artificial intelligence, referred to Musk's prophesizing about doomsday scenarios as irresponsible. Zuckerberg should be calling anyone irresponsible. Musk responded on the tweet the next day, calling Zuckerberg's understanding of the topic limited. Zing! And comparing the threat of AI to that of nuclear war with North Korea is clearly a tactic meant to shock, as Musk has been wont to do this on this topic. Earlier this year, he laid out a scenario in which AI systems meant to farm strawberries, but they could lead to the destruction of mankind as they discover that mankind is destroying the planet. And even if Musk is speaking in hyperbole, though, it is not hard to see that why an AI system that outsmarts humans at military strategy might be a cause for concern. Musk's opinions on the technology have been at odds with that of those tech leaders like Zuckerberg, Amazon's Bezos, and co-founders of Google, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. All have been advocates for AI in recent years with few, if any, reservations. And while Tesla, the company, relies heavily on artificial intelligence in developing its self-driving cars, Musk's opinions have been at odds with those of his fellow tech titans. In July, Musk told a group at the National Governors Association summer meeting in Rhode Island that he believes AI should be regulated proactively before the need for such limitations even arise. I have exposure to very cutting-edge AI, he says, and I think people should be really concerned about it. That should be, you know, pretty telling in and of itself. And if I can get this next tab to click. Let's click, 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 clicky, click. There was a story about Musk going up in front of the UN. Again, I know he's done it before, but I think this was a new event telling them that killer robots is a bad idea. All you got to do is watch Terminator. I was pretty surprised at how close it was to reality. And we're going to see. I'm not going to give up because my monitor is going to go off. Okay. This is August 21st. So this was yesterday. Elon Musk and over 100 AI experts are urging the UN to ban killer robots before it's too late. Elon Musk and more than 100 leaders and experts in artificial intelligence have come together urging the UN to commit an outright ban on killer robot technology. An open letter signed by Musk, Google's DeepMind Mustafa Suleiman, and 114 other AI and robotics specialists urged the UN to prevent, quote, the third revolution in warfare by banning the development of all lethal autonomous weapon systems. The open letter, released to coincide with the world's largest conference on AI, which was IJCAI 2017, took place in Melbourne, Australia this week, and it warns of a near future where independent machines will be able to choose and engage their own targets, including innocent humans, in addition to enemy combatants. So like you and me, and like I always saw, the killer drones chasing us and filming us in HD, projecting your image on live TV, pay-per-view for them to watch the drone chasing the fugitive. I wouldn't doubt it, guys. And we are just at the very beginning of this. Once developed, they would permit armed conflict to be fought at a greater scale than ever, at timescales faster than humans can even comprehend, the consortium writes. And I've told you guys that everybody thinks that this is 20, 30 years from now, and I'm telling you, no, it is not. This stuff is moving at an exponential pace, and there are things happening in private, scary, deep, dark labs down scary, long hallways that we have no freaking clue right now, and Israel is involved in probably all of them. So we have no clue, and it's all in the name of warfare. It's all in the name of the military-industrial complex and fighting terrorists and fighting hate speech. Finding insurgents, cracking down on freedom and liberties. This is not in your best interest. All right, I'm going to open this over here because I have a spinning wheel right now. All right, anyway, this is not the first time Musk and those of his worldview have united to draw attention to the threat of autonomous weapons to humanity. These can be weapons of terror, weapons that despots and terrorists use against innocent populations, and weapons hacked to behave in undesirable ways. This will not be the first time. SpaceX and Tesla chief has also been behind OpenAI, which is a not-for-profit devoted to advancing ethical AI research. But despite concerns, AI experts are voicing ongoing delays in developing an effective ban against autonomous weaponry have led some to fear that the dangers could be beyond regulations, especially given the rapid pace at which AI systems are developing. We do not have long to act, the open letter reads. Once this Pandora's box is opened, it will be hard to close. The third revolution to which the campaigners refer positioned killer robots as a kind of technological successor to the historical developments of gunpowder and nuclear weaponry and innovations that haven't exactly improved the world we live in. Well, the new letter isn't the first instance in where experts have leveraged the JICAI to make their point. This is the first time that representatives of AI and robotics companies of some 26 countries have made a joint stand on the issue, joining the ranks of independent researchers such as Stephen Hawking, Noam Chomsky, and Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. The number of prominent companies and individuals who have signed this letter reinforces our warning that this is not the typical hypothetical scenario, but a very real, very pressing concern which needs immediate action, says the founder of ClearPath Robotics, Ryan Garapi. We should not lose sight of the fact that unlike other potential manifestations of AI, which still remain in the realm of science fiction, autonomous weapon systems are on the cusp of development right now. And that last point is one that should be emphasized, that while the ultimate nightmare of autonomous weapon systems could be the future populated with T-800s, oh my God, like in the one on the top of this page, that would be Terminator, the reality is that AI-based killing machines are already a thing. Autonomous or semi-autonomous capability are increasingly being built into weapons like Samsung's, and they do have a military division, SGRAI Sentry Gun, and BAE Systems Tyrannus Drone, and DARPA's Sea Hunter Submarine. In other words, the technological seeds of tomorrow's killer robots are already in existence on land, sea, and air, and effective laws to regulate these lethal machines and the industry that is hell-bent on making them haven't yet been written down. So there is no time like the present. Nearly every technology can be used for good and bad, and artificial intelligence is no different. And there was another story, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to grab it before the bells go off here, but IBM's Watson, I think it was Watson, has now, or one of the Watson labs, has now been turned towards some military laboratory to work on some new technology for warfare. So, all right, hopefully I'll be back again tomorrow. Everybody, take care.